And good afternoon. It's the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. I'm Taylor. And Phil Conlon is here. How you doing, Phil?
Hello, Phil. I'm good, thanks.
You are good.
Well.
We're going to tell...
That's the story, and we're sticking with it.
You're sticking with it. Actually, Phil, you went... Friday morning, we were talking
yes.
with you. You have been operated on since the last time we had this show.
Yes. Yes.
I can't remember. Were you here last Monday?
No, I was not.
Nope. You had a little problem.
I had a little problem on Monday that got worse as the night progressed. And
this gives us a chance to talk about socialized medicine, as the Americans call it.
Oh, yeah. Terrible communist plot. When we were growing up, they warned us.
How did that work out for you?
Well, first of all, I got to tell you,
This is a Canadian story told with a New York accent.
Right,
so
yes.
Our listeners in Buffalo and et cetera will appreciate
that. So first of all, I have to tell you that I got to pay the ambulance service less than $100.
Yeah.
For which I got two incredibly well-trained medics who showed up, was able to shepherd me down two flights of stairs, and in the 6 or 7 minutes it took to get to the hospital to do an EKG and take all kinds of tests and have it printed out and hand it to the emergency physician as they wheeled us in. All with a very respectful manner and very knowledgeable guys, you know, and I thought, wow. And that's the only part of the service.
Were you thinking wow at the time, or were you just saying, oh my God, this hurts?
Well, I was thinking more of that, but actually, you know what? As long as I was conscious, I was watching the process, because this was all new to me. I worked on the other side of it. I worked for years in an emergency room, but I've never been the patient, right? So
that often is an edifying experience for doctors themselves.
It is. I can see why it would be, because it's like, I'm the kind of person who used to make a living in this kind of atmosphere, you know, not the kind of person who needed the services of this atmosphere. Yeah. So, you know, it was something. And I have to say that our system, which has a lot of faults these days and a lot of politicians trying to undermine it and squeeze it for funds, still works extremely well. And the one question I was never asked was about, how are you going to pay for this, of course,
because exactly.
They know.
Yeah, they tell you.
Yeah, and I wasn't even approached by the accounting office until after the surgery and say, no.
Well, that's good. But think how many patients in the U.S. system are the private business, they have to add that anxiety to the condition they have.
Of course they do.
And they're thinking to themselves, even if they discuss symptoms, they're thinking, I wonder if that's going to cost a lot to find out.
Well, you know, and that part of my brain which goes in for accounting, and I keep that part of my brain well under control, but
accounting?
Accounting, yeah. I mean, I was like looking at, you know, okay, there's the x-ray technician and the x-ray machine. Then there was the CAT scan. And then there's all this, all the equipment around that stuff. Then there's all the blood tests and... there were some other procedures that I won't go into, but which involved some real, some capital equipment, let's say. And I'm thinking, wow, I mean, this must be costing $10,000.
Yeah. No, it's phenomenal and good for you. And so you would like, you're making basically a shout out to the medical professionals and all the...
The professionals and the workers, because part of what makes it work is that the hospital has people like the porters.
We can name the hospital, can't we?
Oh, St. Michael's, absolutely. Yeah. I worked there once 50 years ago.
If you're a St. Michael's person, Phil Conlon really appreciates the quality and sensitivity of the care.
And I really want to say something about nurses, because they...
Say something about nurses.
Nurses, because they take a lot of crap. And now we have the finance minister...
Like teachers, right?
Yes, very much like teachers. And the finance minister and premier are shocked. They're just shocked at how much money that these nurses are walking home with, right? I mean, like, we can't have that. We're going to have to freeze their wages, which they've actually been doing for the last 5 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And from what I could see and from what I could observe of the nurses, I mean, you could not pay them enough for what they do, you know? And they only have to make one mistake and you can lose your livelihood after 20 years. I mean, it's not as if they get an academic qualification and they have the degree. They've got to remember it all every day, you know?
Yes.
And there's no room for error.
And update their skills.
Yes.
Because
yes.
there's new material, new... ideas about how to do each thing. Yeah. Thank heaven we saved a lot of lives because of the increased skill levels. Well, all of you people at St. Michael's, put that on your resume. And if you need a witness, Phil Conlon is prepared. Phil Conlon's program is Wednesday, 6 p.m., 6 to 8, Classical Underground. And look at that. He wasn't here last Monday. He's here Monday, and he's had surgery in between and got wonderful treatment. And there's the ambulance there's already, coming for
us. We arranged that. I mean,
what did you say wrong? Yeah. This is the Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. And today we're going to, by the way, at the halfway point, 5:30, we're going to be talking to retired professor Keith Ellis. He's also a poet. He's a translator. And we had him on the program last Monday. And he opened up, for, at least for me, a chapter about South America that I had never understood, knew little about, and it was, let's call it a minor revelation. And it all started with our discussing the recently deceased important author of South America, Eduardo Galeano, about whom there's, my goodness, there's a lot of discussion. This is a very important man. We were and his most famous book, I think he's known for, is Open Veins of Latin America, Five Centuries of the Pillage of a Continent, Eduardo Galeano. So we had asked a question, and the subject of Paraguay came up, and it was that Professor Ellis wanted to focus on. And today we're going to return to the subject, because we're going to discuss why this story has been so maybe badly understood over the years. Other matters I want to take up today, there is the matter, the events of Cabejo. After all these years of talking about this subject, I now manage to mispronounce it, Cabejo, in Rwanda. And there was a massacre that took place there in mid-April, 1995, about 1 year after the great bloodletting known as the genocide, the war genocide of Rwanda. And the state, those in power, had refugee camps around the country and outside the country. They decided it'd be a good idea to close them. And they went about it in a way that led to terrible massacre at Cabejo. We want to talk about that. And also, we're going to another historical event. Maybe we'll start with this, that one, and that is the liberation of American slaves through the war, the Civil War. And there's some dates to note. Today is the April 27th, so 150 years ago today, the body of John Wilkes Booth was shipped back to Washington. He had been killed on the night of the 26th by a Sergeant Boston Corbett, who found John Wilkes Booth and his cohort, Davy Harold, hiding in a tobacco barn. And that was on the 26th. He had killed Abraham Lincoln on the 14th and then had managed to escape capture for some time. And it's the reason I think it's important to commemorate the date and to think about April 1865, is that these events are still, in 2015, misunderstood and not properly talked about. And in the case of Booth, it's usually told that he was a passionate Confederate sympathizer who lost his mind when his great cause was defeated and decided on his own to take the life of President Abraham Lincoln. But that is shown to be false by what happened next, because when I said he escaped by the assistance of Confederate agents. So why were Confederate agents, after the defeat of their principal armies, helping one of their, helping this assassin, who were, by the way, mainstream liberal historians all want to say, oh, the South was appalled. Why did the members of the Confederacy, who were each of them a member of the Confederate intelligence, remember, armies always, states have intelligence groups. Each of these people played a key role. There are four or five of them. We won't bother to go through the names. But in the initial days of escape, Booth met and was assisted by professionals. That's why he was so long on the loose. And he was, and so that part of the story needs to be emphasized. He eventually was betrayed. It is assumed, by the way, and this is another little known story, that when he that he was seen crossing the Potomac River, that it was at first reported by black Americans, some, but we don't know their names, but there were people who were watching. The small bit players in history, by the way, often just disappear totally. Who gave the word? Who passed the word about who was doing what? Jefferson Davis, who led the slave states, complained at near the end, and all of his friends, that those, quotes, Negroes that they had confidence in had turned out to be traitors and were, strangely enough, working for the Union against slavery. Who would have guessed? But certainly not. Jefferson Davis felt personally betrayed, and I would like to congratulate him and tell him, yes, indeed, sir, you were. But so Booth was spotted, and they closed in on him, and on the night of the 25th, 26th, at a place called the Garrett Farm, the Union soldiers surrounded the tobacco barn in which he and Harold had been made to go and spend the night. The first night at the Garrett Farm, they had been welcome in the home, but the owner of the farm, Garrett, became suspicious that Booth might be a thief. I think he may have also thought this guy could be a hot potato, and maybe it's better not to have him in the house, because there seemed to be a lot of interest in him by certain people in the district. So they said, if you don't mind, go sleep in the barn. So he did, and he was in the barn when the army arrived, and they told him to come out. And he said he would not. He said he'd fight them. You know, he wanted to do it mano a mano. And they said, no, that's not the rules. Come out, or we're going to get you out. And so he refused to come out, and they set fire to the tobacco barn. So at that point, Davy Harold said he wanted to go out. So Booth yelled, my friend here wants to give up, so if you can have him. And so Harold left. And then, but as the fire began to burn, tobacco barns are not large, they are built for ventilation. So Mr. Corbett could, through the slats of the barn, could see Booth. And when he saw Booth raise his rifle toward the entrance, Boston Corbett, as he was known, did the right thing and shot him. And the bullet broke his spinal cord, and he fell to the ground, and they rushed in, took him, dragged him out. He lay alive for 2 or 3 hours, and our whole culture has grown up around, what did he do during the final moments? Did he name his favorite girlfriend? Did he send him a letter to mama? Did he write a novel, recite a poem? He probably didn't say a thing. Somebody said he asked if they would show him his hands, and he realized he used the word useless, and they dropped, let go of his arm. But anyway, he was killed on the 26th. His body was shipped back to Washington, and his collaborators were arrested. Mr. Davy Harold was hanged, along with Mrs. Surratt, who was part of the conspiracy. No question in my mind, I don't care what Hollywood thinks, there's no question anybody looks at that knows that she was part of a very dedicated group of secret Confederates who carried out a lot of bad things on behalf of the slaveocracy. And so they were put to death. Now, another element of this that I want to make sure we call attention to, again, April of 1865, and that is that this capture of Richmond, and I'm proposing, for those who, in memory of Ferguson, that we call it by its right name. It was, many people say, it was a conquest or conquering of Richmond, but it's actually liberation. It was until, as I've pointed out in this program, on April 31st, they were still selling slaves. The slavery didn't end until the Union Army entered the city of Richmond, walked in, and captured it. And at that moment, it was only that moment, that the Americans, black Americans, who had for 250 years provided the labor and the wealth of this ridiculous ruling class of the South, the King Cotton. All the work was done by the slaves. And they were Americans. They built and shaped the country. Already, after all those years, the culture was enriched in every department. But they were slaves. And only when the Union Army marched in was it over. Because until that happened, they were still under the thumb of the white rulers of Richmond. And so that should be noted. Now, another thing that must be noted, and I notice that nobody likes to note it, is that there were brigades of colored, what were called colored troops. And that was the label, colored troops. And they were under a general. His name was Weitzel. The general who captured Richmond and ran it efficiently and put out the fires set by the Confederate leaders. Of all the fires of the city, everyone agrees, were deliberately set, and it destroyed downtown Richmond. That was all done at the orders of the Confederate leaders. Now, I understand war. They say you're supposed to leave ashes for your enemy, but they are the ones who did it. And the fires that they set were put out by the Union Army, and there was no pillage, and there was no robbery. That's agreed. The Union troops were highly disciplined, and we are talking about white troops and colored troops. They were disciplined. They put out the fires, and they put order on the streets of Richmond. And finally, black Americans could come out into the streets. And as many of the white people of Richmond noted, they were seeing for the first time colored people walking down streets where they did not belong. They weren't supposed to be there. They were not free. Now, let's remember, those are Americans. But the caste system, the racially established caste system, is a powerful thing. If you want to understand Ferguson, refer yourself to the Civil War and the rationalizations that go on for that war. And it's the great cause. The great cause deprived 4.5 million Americans of freedom to walk down a street. They could not do it. And so at that moment, and I want to tell you a nice detail, Weitzel, born in Germany, and 30 years old, was in charge of the whole city of Richmond. And he gave all the orders. And he ran that thing like it needed to be run. He had a second officer who was 25 years old. The number two man under him was 25. For all you people wondering what to do with your lives, I'd say get busy if you want. But let's go to the colored troops. The question was asked, well, we're marching through the city now. Is it okay if the colored troops march? Because this is going to be a shock. And he said, of course. So the colored troops marched through Richmond. Now, they had a visitor, as you know, Abraham Lincoln. I read last night, just to prepare myself, an account of the last days by a Confederate. And he talked about the horrors of the arrival of the Union Army, but he admitted that they were disciplined. But he left out two details. He left out that Abraham Lincoln came on April the 4th, and he left out any mention of colored troops. He could not bring himself to even utter those words. There were 200,000 colored troops. I grew up in the States, and I never knew any of this. We were never told that. They fought in 200 battles, and they took some of the worst hits, by the way. And when they were captured, they were not treated as soldiers. That's one of the reasons that we had terrible moments in prisons, because the Confederates would not regard them as combatants. Instead, they were slaves, and that many of them were sold. A lot of them were executed. A white officer, according to Jefferson Davis, if he had colored troops, he had to be executed. That was Jefferson Davis, you know, the father of the great cause, noble, you know, blah, blah. Anyhow, so I'm going to read you something here from a wonderful book by Ernest B. Ferguson. How appropriate, Mr. Ferguson. It doesn't spell the same way. Ashes of Glory, Richmond at War. And he describes the following scene. I've read this over the years, and I often cannot finish reading, but I think I can do it today. So the 28th United States colored troops marched through Broad Street toward camp, and they were halted by a vast multitude that clamored for a speech. The multitude were black Americans in Richmond. Half of the population of Richmond were black. In response, the regimental chaplain stood and proclaimed for the first time, in that city, freedom of all mankind. For the first time in Richmond, freedom for all mankind. Then was so overcome that he could not continue. By the way, the man speaking is black. He's with the colored troops. He's the chaplain. Later, a black woman came to ask, this is, by the way, eyewitness. A reporter wrote this. I saw it happen. Later, a black woman came to ask if anyone knew a former slave who had been sold as a small boy to Robert Toombs, the Georgian, who became a Confederate general and Secretary of State. The woman had seen Toombs in Richmond and learned from him that the boy had run away to Ohio. She asked the chaplain, "What's your name?" "Garland H. White," he said. "What was your mother's name?" "Nancy." "Where were you born?" "Hanover County, in this state." "Where were you sold from?" "From this city." "Well, what was the name of the man who bought you?" "Robert Toombs." She was hard to satisfy. Question followed question, until at last she said, "This is your mother, Garland, whom you are now talking to, who has spent 20 years of grief about her son." So that's what happened in Richmond. She went out and to see the black troops, hoping she might find her son. 20 years of that. You want to remember that the whole, if you read the rationale of the Confederates for their system, was that, you see, the such sensibility didn't exist, according to them, that you could sell a mother's child right out from under her, and she wouldn't care. That would, you know, because they're not like us. That would be the rationale. And that bit of poison got into our system, and we need this story to be told. As far as I'm concerned, there ought to be a statue in Richmond to Garland White and his mother, and at the spot where they would have met, because Richmond needs to be liberated, and it needs to be cleared up. Because the big debate emerged that said, well, you don't want to hurt their feelings, you know. And so I have the question, whose feelings are you talking about? Mr. Spielberg, who made his film about Lincoln, and I'm not an admirer of that film, spent his time in Richmond. But in the film, he didn't let President Lincoln get to Richmond. Lincoln never went there. And when he was asked by a Richmond reporter, well, you know, what do you think this film would do? Because, you know, people are sensitive about that name Lincoln in the South. He said, well, I hope it will contribute to the healing. And so my question is, between who and whom? Is that the right grammar? Who and whom are you talking about? Because the mother of Garland White, she needs the healing. These other guys, they have to make up their mind what they think of Garland White and his mom. And I want to know what they think about them before I'm going to talk about healing with them. We got the dialectic all wrong. It was the slaves were liberated. That's the whole idea. Now, of course, because of racism and the power of it and the desire of the whites to claw back into power, they played the race card forever. That's what they said, oh, this is about race. Well, I suppose it was, in the sense that black Americans had every right of every other American from the moment 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments came into existence, which is why the state of Mississippi discovered the other day that, you know, what, a year or two ago, that they hadn't actually signed those 14th, 15th, and 16th, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. They said, oh, yeah, okay, I forgot about that. Yes, you did. Sure you did. Anyhow, that's city of Richmond, the South, was liberated. Anybody who didn't like that was, in fact, a traitor, as the old-fashioned language. If the word means anything, that's what they were. And they had engaged in, as what W.E.B. Du Bois said was the great absurdity of claiming they're fighting for freedom in order to deprive somebody else of theirs. Did happen. Now, in a few minutes remaining, I would just say that on the 18th of April through the 22nd of April, 1995, the RPF in Rwanda carried out a slaughter at Kibeho, and I have a little text to clarify that. I want to thank Ann Garrison and David Peterson, two wonderful people who've been making sure that the world doesn't forget, because the way to write history is, of course, to eliminate stuff, and then you get to tell any kind of silly story you wish. But these things happen. And this massacre was of a camp of 150,000 people who were encircled by an army, who then decided to crush the camp. And they were refugees, by the way, under UN protection. And who do we know? How do we know what happened? Well, as David Peterson, Ann Garrison, and others have pointed out, there were observers, international observers, present. The Australian Medical Corps was there, and they had, and we've interviewed on this show, Terry Parker, Picard, pardon me, who actually saw it with their own eyes. But somebody else saw it, who seems to be forgotten. People know the name General Dallaire. And they say Unimir, you think Dallaire. But there was a Canadian Major General, Guy Toussaint. And he replaced Romeo Dallaire in August of 1994. And he was there at the time this happened. And here's what he had to say. He wrote a book, by the way, but fortunately we have this magic device in Canada to prevent each other from knowing what's going on. He wrote it in French, and no English publisher has brought that book out. They brought out the book by the English-speaking general, Dallaire, but Toussaint, they did not. According to Toussaint, Kagame gave the orders to attack the camp of 150,000 refugees and kill between 4,000 and 8,000. Toussaint's description of how the numbers were manipulated is chilling. Toussaint's men had already reached a count of 4,000 dead, while the United Nations Rwanda Emergency Organization estimated that 8,000 had been killed. Then they had done the job of counting. If you're going to respect General Dallaire, why don't you respect General Toussaint and get to the bottom of this one? Because that is his element. Counted. The UN Secretary General's special envoy, Mr. Khan, appeared on the scene, and this is a quote, and said, "All this smells bad. Can we not reduce those numbers?" Toussaint replied, "With all respect, sir, you are asking me to lie, and I find that very difficult." Toussaint speculated that Khan was trying to, quote, sell a somewhat acceptable image of the new Rwanda in order to please fundraising agencies. I personally would look a little further than that for the devil, but anyhow. Shortly thereafter, the Canadian ambassador, Dussault, suggested, why not set up a commission of inquiry to reassure the funders who will surely use this incident to cut off funding that is already lacking? What a warm-hearted character he is. So they wrote up a bunk report. But that's what happened. Ann Garrison and David Peterson have already done a lot of the spade work. You can look at their names and you come up with all the data you need. You're listening to the Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and we're at Facebook/ The Taylor Report. With all that information, we'll take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk to Professor Keith Ellis.